The trio of wolves moved through the night, leading their horses. Gonzalez walked out ahead, picking the path, followed by Valentine and Harper, each taking two horses. As they drew close to the fire, Valentine decided the burning buildings were just another abandoned farm in a region where two out of three homesteads were empty. New Forest stood in fields that had once belonged to cows. The wolves tied up the horses near a shallow seasonal stream bed, and the horses drank from runoff puddles scattered among the rocks. They could see the flames flickering through the thin-skinned trunks of scrub beech and young oaks. They crept up to within 50 feet of the dying fire. What was left of four buildings, one obviously a barn, had already collapsed into burning debris. Without the daily rains of the past week, the conflagration would have turned into a forest fire.
Okay, Lieutenant, here's your fire. What now?
No family, no neighbors. Must have been empty. These fields sure don't look used. I haven't seen anything but a few old fence posts around with the wire stripped off, so why is it burning?
Maybe a patrol came through, livened up a quiet night with a little arson. That east-west road we crossed yesterday by the river's got to be up there somewhere.
Could be. If so, they used a lot of starter. You could smell it from here, kind of like gasoline.
Gonzalez and Harper sniffed.
Reminds me a little of napalm. The Groggs used it at Cedar Creek. They had an old fire truck filled with it. Doused some of the buildings our guys were holed up in, and then lit it.
Like to take another look around in daylight. We can wait a few more hours before moving on. Let's get the horses and find a safe spot to sleep.
Valentine could tell from Harper's expression that he thought getting some rest was the first sensible plan out of his superior's mouth all evening. Daylight inspection of the ruins told the end of the story, but not the beginning. While Gonzalez squatted in cover along the road, ready to run like a jackrabbit back to the fire scene at the first sign of a patrol, only a livestock-laden tractor-trailer passed along the old highway, crawling east at a safe 15 miles an hour along the potholed road.
This makes no sense. We've got four buildings burning, or three buildings and a shed, I guess, but what are those other three burn spots?
Valentine indicated the blackened brush, circles of fire 12 to 30 feet in diameter, scattered around the buildings on what had once been lawn and garden. A disinterested Harper glanced around him.
Weird thing number two, look how the house is wrecked. The frame's been scattered all to hell, but only westward. Like a bunch of dynamite was set off on the east side of it.
Harper shrugged.
Maybe the Quislings were training with demolitions or something.
Then where's the crater? And the foundation is in good shape. Those cinder blocks would be gone if someone put a charge there. And look at those two saplings. They're both broken off 3 feet up, but the tops are lying toward the house. An explosion wouldn't do that. Weird thing number three, that hole dug in the ground by the barn.
The men walked over to the ruins of the old barn, next to the blackened column of the still-standing silo. A triangular furrow, 3 feet long and almost 2 feet deep, was gouged into the ground. A dug-up divot of earth and grass lay 9 feet away in the direction of the barn.
What did this? The patrols brought out a backhoe? This was dug out in one clean scoop?
You got me, Sherlock.
And finally, there's no tracks. Unless that's why they burned out those patches of the scrub, to cover the tracks, or the marks of the weapons that did this.
Valentine kneeled and sniffed at the charred wood. It still retained a faint petroleum or medicinal smell, like camphor.
Somebody's coming.
He moved swiftly behind the silo, rifle already at his shoulder. The person was not making any effort to keep quiet, whoever it was. A middle-aged man in faded blue pants and a striped mattress-ticking shirt emerged from the forest. He surveyed the wreckage, not looking particularly surprised. He removed his baseball cap and wiped his face and neck with a yellow handkerchief. What was left of his hair, balding front and back, was a uniform gray.
Whoever you are, you're sure up early. Come out and show yourselves. I ain't armed.
Valentine hand-signaled Harper to stay concealed. Gonzalez had vanished, perhaps into the overgrown drainage ditch next to the road.
Good morning to you, too. I'm just passing through.
You mean we're passing through, stranger? I saw your buddy behind the silo. Since you're not from around here, I'll ask your name, son.
David, sir. I'm down from Minnesota. Visiting friends, you might say.
The man smiled.
If that's the case, I'd keep that repeating rifle hid. I don't know how it is in Minnesota, but around here the vampires will kill you for carrying a gun, among other things.
Thanks for the tip. We're trying to pass through without attracting attention. You live around here, sir?
All my life. My name's Gustafson. I'm a widower now and my kids are gone. I farm a little place up the road. Saw the sky lit up and figured it was the old Bauer farm. Don't have much business of my own to mind, so you might say I mind other people's. Just to have something to do.
That could be good or bad for us, Valentine thought.
Did anyone live here?
Not since they took over. The Bowers all died of the raving madness. No one's wanted to live here since. It's 5 miles from nowhere.
I wonder what started the fire. There's been a lot of rain, but no lightning.
I wonder myself. I hear from some of the Teamsters there's been a few mysterious fires this summer. Started right around the time the new big boss showed up in Glarus. And things have gone from bad to worse for a lot of folks around here since then. There's been disappearances in almost every town, and I'm sure you know what that means.
I'm surprised you ask questions, Mr. Gustafson. Most places that's frowned upon.
My curiosity's all I got left, David.
Gustafson thrust his hands in his pockets, speaking to Valentine while standing side by side with him, as was the custom in that part of the country. They looked over the wrecked barn and house.
I've lived a full life, considering the circumstances. After my Annie got took, I quit looking for anything else from this life. I'm setting my heart on the next.
Valentine liked the man on instinct. He thought for a moment about asking the man to come south with them. They had a spare horse, after all, and the Free Territory could always use another farmer or rancher.
I didn't get much formal education. They don't like schools. But I'm smart enough to know that men in deerskins carrying guns and staying out of sight of the roads means trouble for them. So, if you boys want to come to my place, I'll share what I got with you. Maybe you need to spend a couple of nights in a bed. I've got some spares. I'd appreciate the company.
We appreciate the offer, Mr. Gustafson, really. But we gotta move on east.
Valentine lied, just in case.
If you could spare a bag of oats for the horses, we'd be in your debt, sir. I'd really like information about these fires, though. You seem to have your ear to the ground.
It beats me as much as it does you, son. One old man saw some kind of airship over a fire. I don't know exactly where or when. It's a fourth-hand story. Like the old blimps you see in pictures. He said it moved around with sails. And I got a theory about where it's coming from. Somewhere around Blue Mounds. They say it's death to go within 5 miles of there now. Whatever's happening, they got a lot of troops. The commissary patrols are culling stock all over this part of the state, taking good dairy stock and hogs, mostly. It's going to be a hard winter.
Sounds like. You say this new big boss is in Glarus?
It's New Glarus on a map.
We'd better avoid it.
Valentine lied again. He had to account for the chance that Gustafson might be going for a brass ring.
Smart of you, son.
2 hours later, Valentine rode up to the other two wolves, two bags of oats for the horses across the Morgan's broad back.
It went well in there?
Sure, he gave me the feed and I looked around his place. He seems a nice enough man. I didn't want him to get a look at either of you, just in case.
Are we going to move on now?
Sort of. It seems like the Reapers have something big going on around Blue Mounds. It's about 10 miles southeast of here. Good hilly country, plenty of cover. I want to ride over there and see if we can't get a look at what they're up to.
Harper nodded.
Well, not too much of a detour, then. Gotta ask you straight, though, Lieutenant, begging your pardon. Do you have something against getting back to the Ozarks? You got a woman in the family way, and you want to stay out of the territory for a while or something? We could be halfway to the Mississippi by now. We're couriers, not cats.
If I knew a cat in the area, I'd ask her to do it for us. But something that flies and drops firebombs is something Command will want to know about. Especially since whatever this is doesn't make noise. You've seen the little prop jobs the Kurians use on us now and then. They're loud. We'd have heard it. And they can fly at night. Never heard of a plane or a helicopter doing that nowadays.
Maybe they're trying to train harpies to fly in teams or carry bombs together.
Could be. Could be just about anything, Gonzo. The Kurians like dreaming up nasty surprises. But Southern Command is going to want facts. We're all this way anyway. When we get back, we might as well know what we're talking about.
So what's next on the Lieutenant Valentine tour of southwestern Wisconsin?
Valentine consulted his map and compass.
Well, short ride that-a-way. How's your nose this morning, Gonzalez?
Wishing it was smelling the masala in one of Patel's pepper pots right about now, sir. But it's working well enough.
I hope so. We're gonna need it.
You had to hand it to the Kurians, Valentine thought at midday when they struck the line of fence posts. They know how to send a message with easy-to-understand symbols. The wolves sat their horses before the line of rust-colored pig iron posts. Atop each post, at 10-yard distances, a bleached human skull grinned at them. The warning line extended into the woods to either side of them, each skull facing outward in wordless warning to trespassers.
Jesu Cristo.
Grimly, Valentine performed some mental arithmetic. Gustafson had said it was death to come within 5 miles of Blue Mounds, 30-odd miles of perimeter. That worked out to something like 5,000 skulls. The one immediately in front of them was a child's. Valentine dismounted, drawing his rifle from its leather sheath.
I'm gonna have a look around, Sergeant Harper. I want you to stay with the animals. If you hear any shooting, try to break a record going west. Gonzalez, this is a one-man job, and I'd like to have your ears and nose along, so I'll leave it up to you.
Gonzalez removed his broad-brimmed hat and scratched the back of his neck.
Lieutenant, after I was invoked, I learned the way from an old wolf named Washington. And Washington used to tell me, Victor, only idiots and heroes volunteer, and you're no hero. But if I stay behind, it means all these skulls worked. I don't like to see anything the Reapers do work.
He slid off his horse and began filling his pockets with 30-06 rifle shells from a box in his saddlebag.
Lieutenant, watch your step now. I can see a lot of tracks just behind this picket line of theirs. I'm going to take the horses down to that ravine we crossed and wait for you. Be careful. I'm going to make cold coffee for three, and I don't want any wasted.
Thanks, Harper. No heroics now. You hear anything, you just leave. I haven't looked at what's in those mailbags, but it's probably more important than we are.
Valentine and Gonzalez moved slowly through the heaviest woods they could find, zigzagging toward three hilltops they could occasionally glimpse through the trees. They moved in a 20-yard game of leapfrog. First one would advance through the woods to cover. He would squat, and the other would move up past the first. They used their noses, and when Gonzalez picked up the scent of cattle, Valentine had them alter course to catch up. It was a warm, partly cloudy day. Occasional peeks at the sun through the cumulus lightened their mood. It would inhibit any reapers around. The cotton fluff clouds were beginning to cluster and darken at their flat bases. More rain might be on the way. They found the cows, a herd of black and white Holsteins, escaping the heat under a stand of trees bordering an open meadow.
That's what we want. I don't see a herdsman. Maybe they round him up at night.
That's what we want? Why, you want cream for your coffee?
No. Let's get to the herd. Keep down in the brush.
They reached the cows, who gazed at the wolves indifferently. The tail-swishing mass stood and lay in the shade, jaws working sideways in a steady, cud-chewing rhythm. About 1,000 flies per cow buzzed aimlessly back and forth.
We need a little camouflage. The smelly kind.
Valentine stepped into a fresh, fly-covered pile of manure. His moccasin almost disappeared into the brown mass. Gonzalez followed suit.
Is this because of the tracks back at the fence?
Yes. I saw dog prints by the hoof prints. Just in case we get tracked. The scent of the cows might confuse the dogs. Step in a few different piles, will you?
Aha!
Valentine made a beeline toward one of the standing milk factories. The cow had raised its tail, sending forth a jet of semi-liquid feces. Valentine quickly wiped his foot in the body temperature pool, then put each knee into it.
Keep an ear open, Gonzalez. It'd be great if one of them would take a leak for us.
I don't even want to know, man. I don't even want to know.
Leaving the cows behind, but taking the smell with them, the wolves began to move uphill, again keeping to the heaviest woods.
So much for my nose, Val. I've heard of wolves in sheep's clothing, but this is above and beyond.
Concentrate on your ears, then.
They cut a trail at the base of the hills. Tire tracks informed Valentine that vehicles passed through this area, circling the hills. Farther up the slope, they could see a metal platform projecting out of the trees, still well below the crown of the hill. It looked like a guard tower, but it was missing walls and a roof.
Maybe it's still under construction.
They moved up the gentle, tree-dotted meadow sideways, approaching the tower from a higher elevation. After completing the half-circle, listening all the way for telltale movement, they gained the tower base. Concrete anchored the four metal struts supporting the 30-foot platform. It was built out of heavy steel I-beams and was well riveted and braced. There was no ladder going up. It was new enough that scars in the earth from its construction were overgrown, but not yet eroded away.
What kind of lookout post is this? That's a lot of steel to hold up nothing.
Gonzalez knelt in the dirt beneath the structure.
Look here, sir. These tracks? Small, narrow boots with heavy heels? Almost small enough for a woman.
A reaper?
That's my guess.
Valentine's spine bled electric tingles. A reaper stands on that platform? Watching what? Standing guard? What the hell is so valuable that the Kurians are using reapers as sentries? He looked at the cross braces. He might be able to climb it if his fingers held out. Of course, a hood would have no problem going up, but it presented quite a challenge to a human.
I'm gonna climb it, see if I can't get a look at the top. Maybe there's some sign of what it's used for up there.
Sir, I wouldn't advise that. Listen.
Valentine hardened his ears and heard thunderous hoofbeats echoing from somewhere over the hill. A lot of hoofbeats. Valentine suspected that these riders would not be scared off by the symbols carved into the butt of his rifle. He looked at Gonzalez, meeting his scout's alarmed eyes, and nodded. They ran. Trained wolves running through heavy wood, even downhill, have to be seen to be believed. They kept up a punishing pace through the thickest forest, a pace no horse and rider could match through this ground. They cleared fallen logs with the grace of springing deer. Their footfalls, like their breathing, sounded inhumanly light. The wolves hunched their bodies atavistically forward, clearing low branches by fractions of an inch. They reached the cow meadow, over a mile from the metal platform, in less than 4 minutes. Valentine altered the downhill course and regained the wood. Still at a flat-out run, they were halfway to the line of skulls when Gonzalez was shot. The bullet struck him in the left elbow as he brought his arm up while running. He spun, staggered, and continued running, gripping his shattered joint close to his body. The sniper panicked at the sight of Gonzalez continuing straight for his hiding spot. He rose, a monstrous swamp troll apparition trailing green threads like a living, weeping willow. The sniper raised his rifle again with Gonzalez a scarce 10 yards away. The scout threw himself down at the shot. Valentine, a few yards behind Gonzalez, was breathing too hard to trust himself to shoot accurately. He shifted his grip to the barrel of the rifle and wound up as he dashed forward. The long camouflage strips hanging from the quizzling sleeves caught in his rifle's action. As he struggled with it, Valentine swung his gun, baseball bat style, using the momentum of his charge to add further force to the impact. Valentine struck the sniper full in the stomach. He dropped his gun and drew his parang from its sheath on his belt. As the gasping quizzling writhed at his feet, Valentine stepped on the man's back and brought the blade down on the vulnerable back of his neck. The blows felt good. Sickeningly good. A release of fear and anger. The body, its head severed, twitched as the man's nervous system still reacted to the blow to the midriff. Valentine moved to Gonzalez, who now sat up, shaking and swearing in Spanish.
Vamos! Get to the horses! I'll catch up!
I need a breather, bud.
He listened to the distant horses. They were far off, maybe far enough.
No, sir. I'll catch up.
Let's get a tourniquet around your arm. I don't want you leaving a blood trail. I'm glad your legs are still working.
Valentine tore a rag off the sniper's ghillie suit, which served that purpose admirably. His hands flew into action with quick, precise movements, binding the wound.
Now hold this.
He twisted a stick around the knot.
Does that arm feel as bad as it looks?
Worse. I think the bone's gone.
Just hold it for now. We'll get you a sling once we get to the horse.
Valentine, this is loco, sir. I can't get far like this. Maybe I can find an old basement or something. I'll hold up for a few days.
No more arguing, hero. Let's go. The posse is on its way. I'll take your rifle.
They walked, then jogged toward the fence line. Each step must be agony for him, Valentine thought. They made it past the skulls and to the ravine. Two horses waited, reins tied to a fallen branch. Valentine's Morgan had a note tucked in the saddle. Valentine uncurled it and read the soft pencil letters.
Followed orders. Good luck. God bless. R.H.
Same to you, Sarge, Valentine thought. He felt lonely and helpless, but it would not do to let Gonzalez see that.
Harper's moving west. Let's go southwest. If they have to follow two sets of tracks, maybe it'll confuse them. I'm sorry, Gonzo, but we gotta ride hard. I'll help you into the saddle.
Valentine tightened the girths on both horses and lifted Gonzalez into his seat.
I'll take the reins, Gonzo. You just sit and enjoy the ride.
Joy. Sure.
They rode up and out of the ravine, Gonzalez pale with pain. Of all the strange Deus Ex Machina, Valentine least expected to be rescued by a livestock truck. Valentine, after an initial mile-eating canter across the hills, slowed out of concern for his scout. Gonzalez could not last much longer at this rate. They spotted an ill-used road, in bad shape even for this far out in the country, and moved parallel, keeping it in sight. The pair crested a hill, resting to take a good look ahead before proceeding farther. Gonzalez sat in his saddle like a limp scarecrow tied to the stirrups. Valentine saw a little cluster of farms along a road running perpendicular to their path. Miles off to the west, a series of high bare downs marched southward. To his right, a small creek twisted and turned, moving south to where it crossed the road under a picturesque covered bridge. The bridge appeared to be in good repair, indicating the road might be in frequent use.
Okay, Gonzo, not much further now. I'm gonna walk the horses for a while in that stream. I want us to pick up an engine.
Are we going to give up the horses?
Yes. We can't go on like this. By the way, do you know how to drive?
Maybe. We worked the steering wheel a couple of times. You would have to shift, though. Can you drive?
I used to play in old wrecked cars, but I don't know what the pedals do.
Sir, let's keep the stream for a while. Get somewhere quiet and find an old house. Lay up for a while.
They might know by now what direction we went. We have to assume they want us, even if we didn't see anything. Remember, we killed one of theirs. They won't brush that off. According to that old Gustafson, they've got some manpower concentrated there, so they'll have the men to do a thorough search. We need to move faster than they can get organized, which won't be easy, since they probably have radios. That means an engine. From the tracks Harper made, and ours, they're going to be looking for us west. If we turn east, we might get ahead of whatever containment they'll use.
Gonzalez nodded tiredly, unable to argue. The scout believed in cautiousness in any maneuver against the Reapers, discretion being the better part of survival. Gonzalez feared everything. Otherwise, he would not have lived so long. The pair rode downhill. At the stream, its rock-strewn bed barely a foot deep in most places, Valentine dismounted and took both pairs of reins, leading the horses. He hoped none of the local farm children were whiling away the afternoon fishing. They reached the covered bridge. After scouting the shaded tunnel to make sure it was unoccupied, Valentine tied the horses to a piece of driftwood and helped Gonzalez out of his saddle. The scout sank into the cool shade, asleep or unconscious within seconds of Valentine laying him down, head pillowed by his bedroll. Valentine scrambled up the brush-covered riverbank. He found a position near one end of the covered bridge where he could see down the road a mile in either direction. The asphalt was patched into almost a checkerboard pattern, as if tar-footed giants had been playing hopscotch along the road. The bridge was a strange bastard construction, obviously a well-made iron and concrete span dating to before the coming of the Kurians, but now covered with a wooden roof. The added-on planks were layered with peeling red paint, and the warped wood seemed to writhe and bend as if wishing to escape from the bridge frame. The drone of insects and the muted trickling of the stream were soothing, and Valentine fought the urge to sleep. He counted potholes in the road, clouds, and bell-shaped white wildflowers to pass the time. A truck appeared out of the east. It was a tractor trailer pulling a livestock rig. It plodded along at a gentle rate so as not to bounce its aged suspension too much over the uneven road. As it grew closer, Valentine saw that the door on the cab was either missing or removed. Valentine readied his rifle and ran to the edge of the covered bridge, keeping out of sight of the truck. He heard the truck slow as it approached the bridge, and the engine noise increased as it entered the echo chamber under the roof. Valentine sidestepped out and into the path of the creeping truck, rifle at his shoulder, and aimed at the driver. The truck came to a stop. A head popped out of the doorless side, heavy sideburns flaring out from a ruddy face.
Hey there, fella. Don't shoot.
Step out of there and I won't. I don't want to hurt you. I just need the truck.
A pair of empty hands showed themselves.
Mister, you got it backwards. We've been looking for you.
What we would that be?
Valentine was keeping the foresight in line with the bridge of the man's nose.
Don't have time to go into it, mister. I know one of you's named David. You're three of those werewolf fellas from down south, right? You went to take a look at Blue Mounds? The vampire's goons spotted you, and now there's a big net out trying to snare you. I heard it on the radio, except the David part. That came across over the lodge's code through the telephone wires. I've been crawling up and down this road for the last hour looking for your tracks.
Valentine lowered his gun slightly.
Who are you?
Ray Woods is my name. Wisconsin Lodge 18. That guy you talked to earlier today, Owen Gustafson, he's the lodge leader here west of Madison. You might say we're like an underground railroad. We get orphan kids and stuff out of the state.
Valentine wanted to believe him badly. But Everready had warned them time and time again to look for traps.
Sorry, Ray, but I can't trust you. If you are who you say you are, you'll know why. We're gonna take your truck, load our horses in it, and take off. If you are who you say you are, you won't tell anybody for a couple hours. I could even knock you out so you have a convincing bump if you want.
Woods plucked at his sideburns, twiddling the curly brown hair.
Now, maybe you can't trust me, but I'm gonna have to ask you to take care of a friend of mine.
The truck driver jumped out of his cab and went to a little door mounted in the side of his truck. He opened it and extracted a toolbox. He then pulled out a metal panel and extracted an 8-year-old boy from the narrow slit like a magician pulling a rabbit from a hat. The boy clung to the driver's leg, watching Valentine with hollow eyes.
This here's Kurt. He's out of Beloit. His father was taken by a reaper a week ago, and his mother just up and disappeared. We're trying to get him over to the Mississippi to a little town called La Crescent. Maybe you can trust him.
Valentine looked into the eyes of the little boy, and they were filled with the hurt confusion of a child whose world had vanished in an afternoon. Valentine wondered if he had looked that way to Father Max some 10-odd years ago. Woods stroked the boy's hair. With Gonzalez hurt, Woods was their best chance of making it out of the Kurian zone. More like their only chance.
Okay, Mr. Woods. I hope you know what you're doing. Maybe you can talk your way out of getting caught bringing a child from point A to point B. But we're armed and wanted. If you get caught with us, the least they'll do is kill you. If you have a family, you better think hard about them.
Valentine was looking at the driver's wedding ring.
Ain't got no family no more, mister. I don't want to be parked out here arguing all day, so what's it gonna be?
What do you want us to do?
10 minutes later, the semi was moving again. Valentine sat in a second secret compartment in the truck's cabin. Concealing himself would be a matter of lying down and closing a steel panel. Gonzalez lay next to the little boy, somewhere beneath him, behind the false-backed tool locker.
Of course, if they make a thorough search, we're all dead. But I'm on the regular livestock run into Blue Mounds now. Before that, I never caused a day's trouble. At least today's trouble that they knew about. In 16 years. Except when the old diesel gives me problems, of course.
The horses rode in the trailer, hidden in plain sight next to two other crowbait nags. Valentine hoped the horses looked worn out enough to pass inspection as candidates for the slaughterhouse. Their saddles and bridles rested inside bags of feed. A few cows and pigs also rode in the trailer, adding to the camouflage and barnyard odor. Woods listened to the Quisling's radio calls on a tiny CB hidden inside a much larger defunct one. He explained that the only place the Quislings never searched for guns or radios was inside the dysfunctional box, its dangling wiring and missing knobs mute testimony to its uselessness. Woods simply popped the cover and turned on the tiny functioning receiver inside.
Only problem is it's just a scanner, so I can't send. I'm gonna get you boys in with the family in LaGrange. Alan Carlson's part of the lodge, and his wife's a nurse. She'll help your man there. Seems like most of the searchers lit off after your other guy. He dumped one of his horses in Ridgeway, and they seem to think one of you's hiding there. They're tearing the place apart, so hopefully he gave them the slip. Better get hid. We're coming up on some crossroads. He might have checkpoints.
For the next half hour, Valentine rode in darkness, lulled by the gentle, noisy motions of the truck. They stopped at one checkpoint, but all Valentine could hear was the exchange of quick greetings between Woods and a pair of unknown voices. The Carlson farm was a nice-sized spread. According to Woods, Carlson was in good with the local authorities. His wife's brother was some kind of Quisling bigshot in Monroe, so he rarely had trouble finding supplies and tools to keep the place up. He even employed another family, the Breitlings, to help him farm the land. Under cover of picking up some livestock for the voracious appetites at Blue Mounds, Woods pulled the truck into the cluster of whitewashed buildings.
Lieutenant, you can pop the box now. You're on Alan Carlson's place.
Valentine climbed into the passenger seat, an improvised upholstery job mummified in duct tape with a horse blanket tied over it. The door on the passenger side was missing as well.
The Quisling's got a real bug about wanting to see all of you at checkpoints. Sucks to be me in the winter.
The wolf looked around. The truck had pulled around behind a little white house, between it and a well-maintained barn. The two-story frame house was screened from the road by trees and had the small, high-roofed look of a building trying to hide itself from the world. 3 feet of foundation showed in the back, and the kitchen door could be reached only by ascending a series of concrete steps. The barn, on the other hand, looked like it wanted to take over the neighboring territory. It had grown smaller sub-buildings, like a primitive organism that reproduces itself by budding. An immobile mobile home stood beyond the barn, under the shadow of a tall silo. A garage with a horse wagon and an honest-to-goodness buggy parked side by side stood on the little gravel road that looped around the barn like a gigantic noose. Farther out, an obviously unused Quonset hut stood in an overgrown patch of brush, and a well-maintained shed completed the picture. Behind the house, cow-sprinkled fields ran to the base of a pair of tree-covered hills. Distant farms dotted the green Wisconsin hills. A man in new-looking blue overalls and leather work boots stepped up the mini staircase to the kitchen door. He fixed a nondescript red baseball cap over his sparse, sandy hair and turned to wave a boy out from the house. A young teen, in the midst of a growth spurt, judging from the look of his too small clothes, emerged as well. He had black skin and closely cropped hair and looked at the truck with interest. Carlson said a few quiet words to the boy, who scampered off to the road and made a great show of poking around in the ditch at the side of the road with a stick. A golden-haired dog emerged from behind the barn and flopped down, panting in the shade, with his body angled to observe the proceedings. Woods jumped out of the truck and performed his trick with the tool locker again. At the sight of Gonzalez's wound, Carlson hollered back to the house.
Quinny! One of them's hurt! I need you out here!
Mr. Carlson, I don't know what you've heard through this network of yours, but my name's David, and I want—
Introductions can wait, son. Let's get your man downstairs.
A red-haired woman came out of the house, moving with a quick, stocky grace. She wore a simple cotton shirt, jeans, and an apron that looked like it had been designed for a carpenter. She pressed 2 fingers expertly against Gonzalez's throat. Woods held the boy from Beloit in his arms. Valentine and Carlson each took an arm and helped Gonzalez. They entered the house, skirting the tiny kitchen, and got Gonzalez into the basement. It was homey and wood-paneled, with a little bed and some clothing that matched the kind the young teen watching the road was wearing. Mrs. Carlson put a finger into a pine knot on one of the wooden panels and pulled. The wall pivoted on a central axis near the knot. A small room with 4 cots, some wall pegs, and a wash basin was concealed on the other side.
Sorry it's so dark. We're not electrified on this farm. Too far from Madison. But there's an air vent that comes down from the living room. You can hear pretty good what's going on above, as a matter of fact. Let's get the injured man down on the bed.
Carlson turned back to the stairs leading up to the main floor of the house.
Molly! Bring a light down here!
Mrs. Carlson extracted a short pair of scissors from her apron and began to cut away at Gonzalez's buckskins.
What's his name?
Injured man of average height.
Okay, injured. Can you move your fingers? Move your fingers for me on your hurt arm.
Gonzalez came out of his trance, summoned by her words. A finger twitched, and sweat erupted on his brow.
Maybe a break. Maybe some nerve damage. I'm not a doctor or even a nurse, you know. I'm a glorified midwife, but I do some work on livestock.
We're grateful for anything. Looked to me like the bullet passed through.
I think so. Seems like it just clipped the bone. There's a lot of ragged flesh for a bullet hole, though. Not that I've seen that many. I'm going to clean it out as best I can. I'll need some light and some more water. Molly, finally!
Mrs. Carlson looked toward the open panel. A lithe young woman of 17 or 18, with the fine features of good genes, fleshed out on a meat and dairy diet, stood at the entrance to the secret room. Her hair was a coppery blonde and was drawn back from her face in a single braid dangling to her shoulder blades. She wore boyish blue overalls and a plain yellow shirt. The shapeless and oversized clothes made the curves they hid all the more tantalizing. She carried a lantern that produced a warm, oily scent. She looked at the assembly suspiciously.
Dad, are you crazy? Men with guns? If someone finds out, even Uncle Mike can't help.
Hush! Molly, I need that lantern over here.
Valentine watched in admiration as Mrs. Carlson went about her business. Mr. Carlson held Gonzalez down as she searched and cleaned the wound. She then sprinkled it with something from a white paper packet.
Doesn't sting quite like iodine and does just as good a job.
Mrs. Carlson began bandaging. Valentine helped her hold the bandage in place as she tied it, but found himself glancing up at the girl holding the lantern. Molly looked down at the procedure, lips tightly pursed, her skin pale even in the yellow light of the lantern. Mrs. Carlson tied up the bandage. And Gonzalez seemed to sag even more deeply into the cot he lay on.
Hate to give you another mouth, but this boy Kurt here is on his way across the river. I'm not supposed to go out that far again for a few more days. Do you think he could have a place here for a little while?
Of course, Ray. Now you better be moving along.
The man turned back to Valentine.
Now we can shake, son. Alan Carlson. This is my wife, Gwen. And you see there my eldest, Molly. We got another daughter, Mary, but she's out exercising the horses. Lookout up the road is kind of adopted, as you might have guessed. His name is Frat, and came up from Chicago about 3 years ago, on his own.
Call me David, or Lieutenant. Sorry to be so mysterious, but the less you know, the better. For both of us.
Well, Lieutenant, we have to get back to the upstairs. The other family who lives on the farm is the Breitlings. They don't know about this room. Same story, better for us and better for them to keep it that way. Their son is with Mary, he's just a squirt. Tom and Chloe are in LaGrange. I sent them there this morning when word came around about your little scrape. They're due back before dark. There's a chance, just a chance, that the house will be searched. If it happens, don't panic. So happens, the local boss is related to me and we stay in their good graces in every way. Frat has a way of staring at our local goons. I think he makes them nervous. They never hang around long.
Glad to hear it. You don't mind if we keep our guns, I hope.
Carlson smiled.
I'd prefer if you did. And take them when you leave. Gun ownership is a one-way ticket to the big straw.
Alan, I wish you wouldn't be so crude about it. He means the Reapers get you.
Ray Woods put the little orphan, Kurt, down on a cot.
Now, Kurt, I gotta leave you here for a couple of days.
The little boy shook his head.
I'm sorry, Kurt. That's the way it's gotta be. You can't sleep with me in the cab again, and I can't take you to the place where I live. These people can take care of you better than I can, till we can get you to the sisters across the Big Blue River. You said you'd never seen a river a mile wide, right?
Don't!
Whether he was objecting to Woods leaving or going to the river, he did not elaborate. Woods looked away, almost ashamed, and left. The boy opened his mouth as if to scream, then closed it again, eyes glassing over into the wary stare that Valentine had first seen.
We'll leave the lamp in here for you. We'll talk tonight if you want, after the Breitlings are in and the lights are out. Now I've got to get your horses hid in the hills. I'd give you something to read, but books are frowned on too, so we don't have any.
His wife and daughter stepped out the door, and Valentine caught the accusing look the young girl gave her mother. Valentine realized the horrible danger their presence brought to the family. He admired Carlson's resolution. In a way, the courage of Mr. and Mrs. Carlson was greater than that of many of the soldiers of Southern Command. The hunters risked their lives, armed with weapons and comrades all around, each of whom would risk anything to save his fellows. Here in the Lost Lands, this unarmed, isolated farm family defied the Kurians, putting their children in jeopardy, far from any help. Valentine wondered if even the bears he had met had that kind of guts. Hours later, Valentine heard Kurt whimpering in his sleep. He rose from his cot and crept through the darkness to the boy's bed. Valentine climbed in and cradled him until the boy gripped his hand and the sleepy keening stopped. Memories long suppressed awoke, tormenting Valentine. The smell of stewing tomatoes and the pictures in his mind appeared as awful and vivid as if he had seen them that afternoon. As he hugged the boy, silent tears ran down the side of his face and into the homemade pillow. LaGrange, Wisconsin. The town of LaGrange is nothing much to speak of,
A crossroads with a feed store and an auxiliary dry goods shop marks the T-intersection of an old state road with a county highway. The irregular commerce that occurs there takes place with small green ration coupons, worthless outside the boundaries of the Madison triumvirate. Across from the feed store is the house and ringing stable of the blacksmith. The blacksmith and his wife are old, work-hard, play-hard bon vivants, and the breezeway between their house and garage is the nearest thing to the local watering hole. One or both seemed always ready to sit down with a cup of tea, glass of beer, or shot of backyard hooch. The blacksmith's wife also gives haircuts, and longtime residents can tell how many drinks she's had by the irregular results. The real LaGrange is in the surrounding farms, primarily corn or bean, hay, and dairy. The small holds spread out beneath the high western downs that dominate the county. Their produce is transported to Monroe and the thrice-a-week train to Chicago. Survival here depends on having a productive farm and not drawing unwanted attention. During the day, the patrols drive their cars and ride their horses, looking for unfamiliar faces. Vagrants and troublemakers disappear to the order building in Monroe and are seldom seen again. At night, the residents stay indoors, never able to tell if a reaper or two is passing through the area. The residents live as a zebra herd surrounded by lions. There is safety in numbers and the daily routine, and sometimes years pass before anyone other than the old, the sick, or the troublemakers gets taken. Their homes are modest, furnished and decorated with whatever they can make or salvage. The Kurian Order provides little but the ration coupons in exchange for their labor, although a truly outstanding year in production or community service will lead to a bond being issued that protects the winner's family for a period of years. The Kurians provide only the barest of necessities in food, clothing, and material to maintain shelter. But humanity being what it is, adaptable to almost any conditions, the residents find a kind of fellowship in their mutual deprivations and dangers. Barn raisings, roofing parties, quilting bees, and clothing swaps provide social interaction. And if they are punctuated with remembrances for those lost to the Kurians, the homesteaders at least have the opportunity to support each other in their grief. Valentine remembered little of his first few days with the Carlsons. Gonzalez's condition worsened, and as his wolf sank into a fever brought on by the shock of his injury, Valentine found himself too busy nursing to notice much outside the tiny basement room. For three long, dark days, Valentine remained at Gonzalez's bedside, able to do little but fret. The wound had seemed to be healing well enough, though just before the fever set in, Gonzalez had complained that he either could not feel his hand at all or that it itched maddeningly. Then, on the second evening after their arrival, Gonzalez had complained of lightheadedness and later woke Valentine by thrashing and moaning. Kurt, the little boy from Beloit, had been sent on his way westward, and the wolves had the basement room to themselves. Mrs. Carlson blamed herself for not properly cleaning the wound.
Or I should have just amputated. His blood's poisoned now for sure. He needs antibiotics, but they're just not to be had anymore.
Valentine could do little except sponge his friend off and wait. It seemed he had been in the darkness for years, but he could tell by the growth on his chin that the true count was only days. Then, on the third night, Gonzalez sank into a deep sleep. His pulse became slow and steady, and his breathing eased. At first, Valentine feared that his scout was slipping toward death, but by morning, the wolf was awake and coherent, if weak as a baby. Valentine summoned Mrs. Carlson, who took one look at her patient and pronounced him in the clear, then hurried upstairs to heat some vegetable broth. Rubber-limbed, Valentine returned to his own cot and lost consciousness to the deep sleep of nervousness and physical exhaustion. That evening, with the rest of the house quiet and Gonzalez in a more healthy slumber, Valentine sat in the darkened living room talking to Mr. Carlson.
We owe our lives to you, sir. Can't say it any plainer than that.
Valentine spoke from the comfort of feather-stuffed cushions in an old wood-framed chair.
Lieutenant, we're glad to help. If things are ever going to change, for the better, anyway, it'll be you boys that do the changing. We're rabbits in a warren run by foxes. Of course, we're going to help anyone with a fox tail or two hanging from their belt.
Still, you're risking everything to hide us.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about, Lieutenant. A way to reduce the risk.
Please, call me David, sir.
Okay, David. Then it'll be Alan to you, okay? What I wanted to say was, with your buddy sick...
He's getting better.
Glad to hear it. But I spoke to my wife, and she says he should stay for at least a couple of weeks. Between the wound and the fever, it'll be a month before you can do any hard riding, maybe. Your horses could use a little weight anyway.
Valentine gaped in the darkness.
A month? Mr. Carlson, we couldn't possibly stay.
David, I don't know you very well, but I like you. But please, let a guy finish his train of thought once in a while. What I'm going to suggest might seem risky, David, but it'll make your stay here a lot safer if we can pull it off. It'll even get your papers to get out of here again. I mentioned to my brother-in-law that I might have some visitors in the near future. Then the next week, I told him about a guy I met during summer labor camp up by Eau Claire. Summer labor is something we get to do now and then, keeping up the roads and clearing brush and such. While I was there, I met some Menominee. As a matter of fact, you look a bit like them. Anyway, I told Mike that I met a hard-working, nice young man who was looking to move down here, marry, and get himself a spread. I hinted that I had in mind that this young guy would marry my Molly and told him that I invited him down to meet her. Of course, he's just made up to fit your description.
Valentine's mind leaped ahead, making plans.
And you think he'd get us some papers? Something official? It would make getting out of here again a lot easier if we had some identification.
Well, it wouldn't cut no ice outside this end of Wisconsin, but it would get you to Illinois or Iowa at least. You'd have to lose the guns or hide them well. You could keep to the roads until the hills begin. If questioned, you could say you're out scouting for a place with good water and lots of land, and that's only to be found around the borders. Also, I'd like to bring your horses down from the hill corral. I hate having them up there. Too much of a chance of their getting stolen. Or us getting the axe for withholding livestock from the boss man.
If you think you can pull it off, I'm for it.
Good. Give you a little chance for some light and air. Also, you can get a taste of life here. Maybe someday a bunch of you wolves will come up north and liberate us. Or just bring us the guns and bullets. We'll figure out how to use them.
2 days later, Valentine found himself standing outside the sprawling home of Major Mike Flanagan, Monroe Patrol Commissioner of the Madison Triumvirate. Or at least, that was the claim of the little signboard on the driveway. Valentine wore some oversized overalls and was barefoot. Carlson had driven him the 23 miles, starting at daybreak in the family buggy. Carlson nodded at the sign.
I don't know about the rest, but the major part fits him. Major asshole, anyway.
Valentine did not have to feign being impressed with the major's home. It was opulent. Half French villa, half cattle baron's ranch, it stretched across a well-tended lawn from a turret on the far right to an overwide garage on the left. Its slate-roofed, brick-covered expanse breathed self-importance. A few other similar homes looked out over Monroe from the north, from what had once been a housing development. Now the mature oaks and poplars shaded only grass-covered foundations, like a cemetery of dead dreams.
Listen to this.
The door opened, revealing two bristling black and tan dogs. Wide-bodied and big-mouthed, they stared at the visitors. The door opened wider to expose a mustachioed uniformed man with polished boots and mirrored sunglasses. He wore a pistol in a low-slung gunfighter-style holster tied to his leg with leather thongs displaying beadwork. Valentine wondered why the man needed sun protection in the interior of the house as well as a gun.
Hey, Virgil.
Carlson nodded to the neatly uniformed man.
Brought a friend to see the major.
Something between a smile and a sneer formed under the handlebar mustache.
Well, I guess he's in for you, Carlson. Normally, he doesn't do business on a Saturday, you know.
Well, this is more of a social call. Just want to introduce him to someone who might be a nephew someday. David St. Croix, meet Virgil Ames.
Valentine shook hands, smiling and nodding. Ames made a show of snapping the strap, securing his automatic to its holster.
He's in the office.
I know the way. Come on, David. Virgil, be a pal and water the horses, would you?
Carlson and Valentine passed a dining room and crossed a high-ceilinged, sunken living room, stepping soundlessly on elaborate oriental rugs. The major sat in his office, copying notes into a ledger from a sheet on a clipboard. The desk had an air of a tycoon about it. Carved wooden lions held up the top and gazed serenely outward at the visitors. The dogs padded past the visitors and collapsed into a heap by the desk. Mike Flanagan wore a black uniform decorated with silver buttons and buckles on the epaulets. he exhibited a taste for things Western, like a string tie with a turquoise clasp and snakeskin cowboy boots. He looked up from his work at his guests, drawing a long cheroot from a silver case and pressing a polished metal cylinder set in a stand on his desk. An electric cord ran down the front of the desk and plugged into a wall socket, which also powered a mock antique desk lamp. Bushy eyebrows formed a curved umbrella over freckled bulldog features.
Afternoon, Alan. You look well. How's Gwen?
Sends her best, along with a pair of blueberry pies. They're outside in the basket.
Ah, Gwen's pies. How I miss them. Sit down, Alan. You and your Indian friend.
The electric lighter on the desk popped up. Flanagan sent a smoke ring across his desk.
How are things in Monroe, Mike?
Flanagan waved at the neat little piles of paper on his desk.
The usual. Chicago's pissed because the Triumvirate is diverting so much food to that new fort in the Blue Mounds. I'm trying to squeeze a little more out of everyone. I'm thinking about upping the reckoning on meat out of the farms. Think you can spare a few more head before winter, Alan?
Some of us can, some can't.
Look at it this way. Your winter feed will go farther.
Well, it's for you to say, Mike, but I don't know how it will go down. There's been some grumbling already.
By whom?
You know nobody tells me anything on account of us being close. Just rumor, Mike. But this visit isn't about the reckonings. I want you to meet a young friend of mine, David St. Croix. I mentioned he'd be visiting and helping me with the harvest.
Pleased to meet you, David.
Flanagan did not look pleased. In fact, he looked perturbed.
Hell, Alan, first you take in little Black Sambo, and now a most ways Indian?
He's a hell of a hard worker, Mike. After I teach him a few things, he can run a fine farm.
Let's see you work hard, boy.
Valentine's mind dropped out of gear for a second, but only a second.
Sorry, Major Flanagan. I traded it last winter. I was hungry, you know. Didn't have my real name on it anyway.
Dumb thing to do, kid. Your lucky Alan here has connections.
Flanagan put down his thin cigar. He rummaged through his desk and came up with a simple form.
Fill this out for him, Alan. Just use your address. I'm giving him a temporary work card, 6 months. If he improves an old spread, I'll give him a permanent one.
I need two, Mike. He brought a friend. There's a lot of guys in the North Woods looking for something a little more permanent.
Don't press me, Alan. Jeez, these guys are worse than Mexicans. Another one is always popping up out of somewhere.
Carlson leaned forward, spreading his hands placatingly.
With two men helping me this fall, I can clear off an upper meadow I spotted. I was also thinking of building a pig pen across the road and raising some hogs, since meat is becoming such an issue. These men can help me, and I can be ready to go in the spring.
Fine, Alan. Two work permits. Your place is going to be a bit crowded.
It's only temporary. Thanks a lot, Mike. Gwen and I really appreciate it. So does Molly, of course. Stop by any time.
Yeah, you're a fortunate man, David. She's a real beauty. Some of my patrollers say she's kind of standoffish, so I wish you luck.
The major pulled out a seal punch, filled out the expiration dates, signed both cards, and punched them.
You're lucky I take this with me. I don't trust my secretary with it. She'd probably sell documents. She can forge my signature pretty good.
I'm in your debt, Michael.
Carlson took the work cards from Flanagan's waving hand.
You've been in my debt since I let that little fart, or whatever his name is, stay with you.
Fret.
Whatever. That big place and nothing to work it but women. I pity you. I'd offer you lunch, but I'm too busy to make it, and Virgil's hopeless. My girl is out at her parents' place this weekend.
Thanks anyway, Michael, but it's going to be a long way back. The horses are tired, so they'll have to walk most of the way.
Thank you, Major Flanagan.
Valentine offered his hand. Flanagan ignored it.
Thank my brother-in-law and his wife, not me. Guess they want a bunch of little half-breeds as grandchildren. Up to me. I take you to the order building and let you wait for the next thirsty blacktooth. Seeing as you don't have a work card and you're in triumvirate lands.
Carlson made a flick of emotion with his chin. Valentine moved past the sleeping dogs and out the door, followed by his benefactor. Flanagan tossed away his cheroot and returned to the papers strewn across his desk. Outside, the horses were very thirsty. Ames was poking in the picnic basket.
Virgil, please take that in, will you? We'll water the horses ourselves. The pies are for Michael, and Gwen put in a jar of preserves for you. She remembers your sweet tooth.
The smile sneer appeared again.
Now that was kind of her. You know where the trough is. I'll bring the basket back out to you.
As Carlson and Valentine brought their horses over to the trough, Alan spoke softly to Valentine.
See what I mean by major asshole?
Seems like he's trying hard for a promotion to colonel.
That evening, after the long ride back, the Carlsons celebrated the legitimate arrival of their guests. Even the Breitlings attended, filling the dinner table past its capacity. As they made small talk, Valentine drew on his memories as a forester in the Boundary Waters to flesh out his David St. Croix persona. Valentine ate at Mrs. Carlson's end of the table, across from Molly, grateful for the room the corner chair gave his left elbow. Pratt sat on his right, eating with the single-minded veracity of a teenager. The Breitlings were next to Mr. Carlson at the other end of the table with the younger Carlson girl, Mary. Gonzalez stayed in his bunk in the basement, still too weak to socialize. Mrs. Carlson explained his absence to the Breitlings as being due to illness and a fall from his horse during the journey south. During the dinner, Carlson told stories about his summer labor, mixed with fictitious ones about how he came to know young St. Croix here. Valentine played along as far as he dared, but worried that the younger girl might say something about the wolves or their horses that would blow the story. Mary kept her 11-year-old mouth shut. Her only comment during dinner was a request to ride Valentine's Morgan someday.
Of course, once he's rested. Anytime I'm not using him, that is. Of course, I'm going to do some riding, looking for some nice land to get a farm going.
Maybe Molly can show you around the county.
Molly focused her eyes on the plate in front of her.
Sure, Dad. Since you went to all this trouble to find me a husband, it's the least I can do. Glad you've given me so much say in the matter. Should I get pregnant now or after the wedding?
Molly?
The Breitlings exchanged looks. Valentine figured that discord was rare in the Carlson house. Molly took up her plate.
I'm finished. May I be excused?
She went to the kitchen without waiting for an answer. Valentine could not tell how much of the byplay was real and how much was acting. 2 days later, he and Molly Carlson rode out on a fine, cool morning with a hint of fall in the air. Valentine's indomitable Morgan walked next to Molly's quarter horse. She wore curious hybrid riding pants, leather on the inside and heavy denim elsewhere, tucked into tall rubber boots and a sleeveless red flannel shirt. They chatted about their horses as they headed west toward the high, bare hills.
Lucy here is great with cows.
Molly patted the horse on the neck affectionately.
They'll follow her anywhere. It's like she can talk to them.
I've always wondered if animals talk to each other.
I think they can, sort of, in a real simple way. Like, if you and I had to communicate by just pointing at stuff. We couldn't write the Declaration of Independence, but we'd be able to find food and water and stuff. Warn each other about enemies. Hold it, Lucy's gotta pee.
Molly stood up in her stirrups while the mare's stream of urine arced into the grass behind her.
You know horses. Those are fine riding pants. You ride much?
No, too much to do at the farm. My sister's the horse nut. But I did make these breeches. I like working with leather especially. I used to have some nice riding boots, but some creep in the patrols took them off me. These rubber ones are hotter than hell, but they're good for working around the cows. I sewed a leather vest for Dad, and when Mom does her calving, she's got a big leather apron that I made.
They trotted for a while. Watching the up and down motion of Molly posting left Valentine desperate to switch the conversation back on.
I get the feeling you don't like a stand.
They slowed to cut through a copse of mixed oaks and pines. The sun had warmed the morning, but Valentine was flushed from more than the heat of the day.
Maybe at first. Still don't know what you're doing here.
Just passing through. I tried to find out what was going on up at Blue Mounds.
You probably wouldn't tell us the truth anyway. I don't know much about the insurgents, but I know you wouldn't tell what you were doing so they couldn't get it out of us just in case. Or is it because I'm just a girl?
It's not that. We have plenty of women in the wolves. And I hear over half the cats are women, too.
We've heard about you. Werewolves. Always coming in the dark, just like the Reapers. Don't you guys go into Kansas and Oklahoma and kill all the people there so the Currians have nothing to feed on?
No. Nothing. Quite the opposite. Just this spring, my company brought over 100 people out of the Lost Lands. That's what we call places like this.
Molly rolled her eyes skyward.
Lost lands. I'll buy that. We're lost, all right. How would you like to spend your life, knowing it's going to end with you being eaten? I developed a lot of sympathy for our cows.
Your uncle seems to be watching out for you all.
Ugh, my uncle. I should tell you about him. No, my uncle doesn't mean shit. A hungry vampire could still take us any night of the week, good record or no. Uncle Mike has done everything in his life exactly as the Kurians want, and he still doesn't have one of those brass rings. And even if you get it, any Kurian can still take it away if you screw up. And if I'm all testy over the husband thing, it's just because it makes me think about something I'd rather not think about. Let's go up this hill. The view's pretty nice from up top.
They walked their horses toward the grassy slope. They crossed a field with a herd of the ubiquitous Wisconsin Holsteins in it, and Molly waved to a man and a boy mending a fence.
That's the Woolrich place. The poor woman who lives there is on her third husband. The first two got taken. One while doing the morning milking, and the second when a patrol came through, just grabbing whoever they could get their hands on because a bunch of reapers dropped in for a visit.
They rode to the top of the hill and dismounted, loosening the girths on their wet animals. The horses began to nose in the tall, dry grass at the top of the rolling series of hills. Farmland stretched below in all directions, crisscrossed with empty roads. 100 yards away, an old highway running along the top of the hills had degenerated into a track cleared through the insistent plant life.
Is that why you don't want to marry? You're scared of becoming a widow?
Scared? I'm scared of a lot of things, but not that in particular. If you want to talk about what really scares me, to answer your question, I don't want the life my mother has. She's brought two children into the world and is taking care of another, and for what? We're all going to end up feeding one of those creatures. I don't want any children or a man. It just means more fear. It's easy to talk about living your life, trying to get along with the system, but you try lying in bed at night when every little noise might mean something in boots and a cape is coming in your house to stick its tongue into your heart. The way I see it, the only way for us in the Madison Triumvirate to beat these vampires is to cut off their food supply. Quit pretending life is normal.
I see.
My grandmother on my mother's side, Grandma Katie Flanagan, she was a teacher or something in Madison before everything changed. When I was about 11, we had a long talk. She was getting old, and I think she felt her time was coming. As soon as the old people slow down, the patrols show up. Sometimes with some bullshit story about a retirement home. She told me about, in ancient times, there were these Jewish slaves of the Romans who rose up and fought them from a fortress on top of a mountain. The Romans finally built a road or something so their army could get up to the fortress. And all the Jews killed themselves rather than be slaves again. Grandma said if everyone were to do that, it would cut off their power or whatever they get from us.
I heard that story too. It was a place called Masada by the Dead Sea, I think. I always used to tell Father Max, he was my teacher, that I wouldn't have killed myself if I were up there. I would have taken a Roman or two with me.
If it had just been another battle, would anyone have remembered it?
That's a good question. Maybe not. I think Gandhi, you know who he is, right? I think he suggested that the Jews should have done something like that when the Nazis were exterminating them. To me, that's just doing the enemy's job for them. Maybe some of you should try to sell your lives a little more expensively.
That's easy for you to say. You have guns, friends, other soldiers to rely on. About all we have is a broken-down old phone system and a set of code words. John really needs a haircut, for we have a family at our place that is trying to go north. Not much help when the vampires come knocking.
Strange how her thoughts mirror mine. I was thinking the same thing the night I got here.
Maybe we can't all commit suicide, but for God's sake, we should quit helping them. We feed patrols, work the railroads, keep the roads repaired. Then when we get old and sick, they gather us up like our cattle. The Kurians got it pretty good. Just because it's human nature to ask for another 15 minutes when you're told you have an hour to live.
Brave words.
Brave? Me?
Molly sat down in the grass and plucked at the burrs clinging to her jeans.
I'm so scared at night, I can barely breathe. I dread going to sleep. It's the dream.
You have nightmares.
No, not nightmares. A nightmare. It's only one, but it's a doozy. Wait, I should tell this properly. We have to go back to Grandma Flanagan again. She told me a story about when the Triumvirate had first got things organized in Madison. I think it was in 2024, in the middle of the summer. They had this group of men, well, some of them were Reapers too, called the Committee for Public Safety. About 200 people were working for this committee, in charge of everything from where you slept to where you went to the bathroom. The three vampires on the committee were kind of the eyes and ears of these Kurians, who were dug into the state capitol building. I don't know how much you know about the Kurian lords, but they sure love to live in big, empty monument-type buildings. I bet a bunch of them are in Washington. But back to the story my Grandma Katie told me. There was this woman, Sheila something or other, who got caught with a big supply of guns. Rifles, pistols, bullets, equipment for reloading, all kinds of stuff. And you think even explosives. One of the vampires said, her punishment was up to the people who work for the committee, and if it wasn't to their liking, they'd kill every last one of them and get a new bunch. So with that incentive, the whole committee goes over to where she's being held, and they tore her to bits with their bare hands. They took the pieces and stuck them onto sticks. Grandma said the sticks looked like pool cues or those little flagpoles from school classrooms, stuff like that. They put her head on one, her heart on another, her liver, her breasts, even her, you know, sex parts. They made streamers out of her intestines and painted their faces with her blood. Then they paraded back to the basketball court at the university where the committee met and showed what they did to her to the vampires. Some of them were drunk, I guess. The Reapers looked at it all and told them to eat the bits or they'd be killed. Grandma said there were fist fights over her liver. Maybe I was too young to be told that story. It gave me a nightmare that night and pretty often ever since. I'm always dreaming that I've done something wrong and the crowd is coming for me. They're all around and they grab me and start pulling me apart. That's when I wake up cold and sweaty. Mary says I sometimes say, no, no, in my sleep. She calls it the no-no dream. It seems silly in the daylight, but try waking up from it at 2 a.m. on a windy night.
I have a dream, or nightmare, I guess, that keeps coming back. Never told anyone about it, not even Father Max. My mom and dad and little brother and sister got killed by a patrol when I was just a kid. I come into the house. I remember it smelled like tomatoes in the kitchen that day, but that's not in the dream. And there's my mother, lying in the living room, dead. Her legs were, well, I guess they had raped her, or started to anyway. They shot my dad in the head. But in my dream, it's like they're still alive. And I could save them if I could just fix the bullet wounds. I press my hands against the blood that's coming out of my mom's throat, but it just keeps pulsing and pulsing out while my little brother is crying and screaming. But I can't save them. I can't.
He looked up at the clouds to try to get the tears to go away. High white cirrus clouds painted the blue sky with icy white brushstrokes.
I guess everyone has their own set of nightmares.
We're getting plenty of help. Whatever happened to your grandmother?
Molly Carlson wiped tears from her eyes with the back of her hand.
Oh, she injured her back and got taken away. The vampires got her in the end, I'm sure. She got driven away by my Uncle Mike. Her son. Her own fucking son.